Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Private Eye office with, as always, as frequently, Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. We are here for our special post-election stats and analysis match. We're very excited. There's been all sorts. I mean, there's been so much news. Adam, you were saying before we started, there have been so much news concertinaed into one night that there's still plenty to unpack. Plenty that hasn't even been noticed. Yeah, since then.
It all happens sort of between 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the morning. I say space these out. I say just let them drip through gently. One of these enormous news events every sort of day for a couple of months would be great.
I think there should be a race to be the slowest constituency to deliver, so that you're Friday afternoon late, and that's a major achievement. Keep us going.
So it's all over. The removal helicopters have been to 10 Downing Street and, you know, there's a new boss. So I thought we'd start off with, before the election, we all made some predictions. So I thought we could get those out now and laugh at how wrong we all were.
This was exactly a fortnight before election day, wasn't it? Where we sat down and wrote.
I would like to point out that, I will concede that mine were not spot on, neither was the exit poll. So in any way, me putting my finger into the wind and going, yeah, probably about that, turns out to have been not that far off the greatest, finest cephalological minds.
That's a very early concession from you, Helen. Maybe you might have forgotten, you might have got it bang on, but I think it sounds like you
No, I can remember it.
You're not auditioning to be the next Professor Sir John Curtis.
If the Conservatives had done as well as the Lib Dems, they'd have 2,000 MPs by now. Interesting stat.
What, on vote share?
Just the number, increasing the number of MPs proportionally sevenfold.
Not very good metric.
How would that work?
Right. Here's me. Andy predicts 2024. Con, 151. Not so far off.
Fine, very respectable.
Lib Dem 48, drastically underranked it. Helen Betts. How much did you put on this? Tories, 110 seats. Lib Dems, 56.
Roughly 15 out, just 17 out on the Lib Dems. But that, I made the same, I would like to put it to you that I made the same error as the exit poll to some extent, right? I was down on Labour, which I have to say I share in common with every single person who's covered the Labour Party, been in the Labour Party, done anything with the Labour Party. You were all miserable as sin throughout all of Thursday.
Well, Helen, you and I spent the whole campaign with me saying it can't be as amazing as the polls are saying. There's no way the Tories are going to go as low. And you went low. If you want to open mine,
let's find out.
This is going to be a big win.
At the moment, let's see what happens when we add Adam into the mix. Tory seats 150, very close. Lib Dems, 67. Spookily close.
Hey, I thank you.
The Lib Dem whisperer, Adam.
Very impressive. Okay. Wow. And finally, Ian, let's turn to yours. It just says Labour will win election.
Bold.
I've been here before. That's great. Sort of insight you need.
What was everyone's favourite moment from the night?
I'd say one of my moments of the night, as I think I predicted a few episodes ago of this very podcast, was that George Galloway lost his seat in Rochdale. And didn't even bother to turn up at the count to see himself lose, as he did previously when he ran for London Mayor. Remember that in 2016? 1.7% of the vote, didn't turn up then either.
There was a great subsidiary moment to that too, right? If you were watching the BBC, you then got to see Neil Kinnock sort of just chortling, I think is maybe the only
Not just chortling, but saying he was a repellent little man. Repulsive little man. Yeah, that was one of the most glorious moments of the night. Actually, I didn't want to sit through a George Galloway speech, but I'm always there for hearing Neil Kinnock slag him off.
That was a very good Kinnock.
Yeah, well, you know.
I thought I was the only impressionist on here with my Rishi and my now completely irrelevant Michael Gove impression.
I've got a horrible feeling that I'm reprising that from a school talent show in about 1986.
Oh, gosh.
It was a night for nostalgia. For many of our listeners, Labour and government, two words that don't go together. Now they're there.
Any other moments from the night?
I enjoyed Ed Davies singing Sweet Caroline in the Lib Dem headquarters, because I was on a sort of personal mission, which I think you might have been too, as you were doing your broadcast round, of saying, can we perhaps fine to hear a bit about Reform, who have performed well in terms of votes, and that hasn't really translated seats to them, which is, you know, sad for them, but that is first past the post. But actually, Lib Dems also got 3 million votes, and we're not really hearing a lot about what the Tory party might want to do to appeal to those voters as well. So actually, I was very pleased that Ed Davey has had a fun campaign. He certainly had the most fun campaign out of everybody. As Adam mentioned on a previous podcast, he talked about carers, for example, something that we otherwise didn't hear a lot about in the campaign. It was like his long centre park summer holiday was over and he was having one last lash before going back to his work in sort of middle management.
It felt so right as he sang Sweet Caroline. I thought to myself, yeah, Davey is exactly the sort of man that would do that.
Ian? The broadcast moment I enjoyed most was almost straight after the exit poll. Nigel Farage appeared and complained that there was no one from Reform on any of the mainstream media channels. And this was absolutely typical of how they reacted. I was watching the BBC where they'd had a Reform man on for the previous 10 minutes talking. So there was an immediate shot of him. And then I turned over to Channel 4 and Anne Whittaker was there. And I thought, immediately, straight away after the poll, you have told the public something which isn't true. So that was a good early moment. Good late moment was Rees-Mogg. And I know everybody else thinks the same, but I'd been storing up the chance to shout Vox Populi, Vox Dei at the television for years. And finally, I got my chance.
That's an interesting point about Reform in the coverage, though, because one of the really odd facets about election night is that all the candidates are at their counts. So actually, they've always traditionally had quite a bit of an issue filling the airwaves. And that's not what you normally do, is you get aligned newspaper columnists from a particular party, or you get the peers, because they obviously don't even get to vote, the peers. But there aren't any, there just isn't that infrastructure around Reform.
The ridiculous thing about election nights, and I'm not entirely serious about them being spread out over months, but you do get that 2 or 3 hours at the front where they're desperately trying to fill time, and all they've got is the exit poll, which in that case, the big story did appear to be a huge surge for Reform. There was a surge for Reform, I'm not writing that off, but it wasn't at the scale that they were saying it was. It was the most extraordinary thing. The BBC, they spent sort of 10 minutes at the top of it saying, we've got cameras in every sports hall around the country. And they kept splitting the screen and showing this feed of people counting votes, which isn't the most desperately exciting thing to watch. And then appeared to cut to almost none of them to see the actual bit that people wanted to see, which was the reading out of the results.
Yes, because there is really interesting drama. Even if you don't know, you know, the individual candidates at a seat, even if it's a seat you don't know very well, there is an interest in hearing the numbers being read out. You think, he got 15,000. I wonder if she'll be able to cap that. You know, the numbers being read out in kind of not in order of number of votes just adds jeopardy and excitement to it. So,
and that is the event that you're watching.
Yeah.
It's not like there are people who are just wandered into their living rooms at 3:30 a.m. in the morning and need to have electoral politics explained to them, right? No, these are dweebs. They know, they know what Ashington is. It's fine.
That's why it gets so exciting, because you get the... Because they're read out in alphabetical order of candidates, aren't they? And that is what made my moment of the night, because I was up for Liz Truss. She was last alphabetically. So every other candidate's tally was read out before hers, I believe.
Yes.
So it created that, you know, what?
No.
Fabulous drama.
Terrific drama. She then refused to give any comment at all and was harried out the door reporters.
She didn't make a concession speech, but she was then asked some questions such as, is this your fault? Do you feel bad? What are you going to do
next?
Is
this karmic justice?
Yeah.
Will you cry now?
Yeah. But it actually had some, I think, bad effects, because they didn't show Bristol Central, which is where Labour's Sangham Debonair lost, as she expected to the Green Party's co-leader Carla Denyer. That was an incredibly hard-fought seat. It was the first time that, you know, one of four Green seats won on the night. Really big moment.
Genuine top news story of the night. That one, yeah.
Really fascinating. And the campaign that was fought there, which had very heavily majored on Gaza, very interesting in terms of Labour's kind of weakness on its left flank. And the other thing that was, it also allowed a really nasty narrative to develop that Sangham Debonair had been a completely graceless loser, when in fact she'd given a concession speech and she did a very nice tweet about Carla Denyer afterwards. But it reinforced that nasty misinformation narrative. And so surely that's one of the things that the BBC is supposed to be against, is giving you the full context rather than you just seeing weird little bits of out of context clips on Twitter or Facebook or wherever it is. So I thought that was a real shame.
At one point, I said up on the screen, it said Tunbridge Wells Lib Dem, which seems to me like a really quite significant moment.
Tunbridge Wells was a significant moment, and they missed it on a lot of television coverage, and I heard it on the radio coverage. And I thought, oh, come on, we're all sitting here waiting to do our not disgusted anymore of Tunbridge Wells jokes, and you're not even giving us the chance. I think it is a failing not to see it.
But of the so farewell thens,
Steve Baker has then, fast catamaran sailed off.
Very sad.
Steve Baker, you have to say, in the end, was rather a good sport about it, because he turned up to the BBC right at the beginning to be told that he was definitely going to lose his seat while sat there in the studio and just sort of laughed off and said, yes, I've kind of accepted that, and then carried on doing the rounds. I mean, he didn't do a Galloway, did he? He actually, you know, he stood up there and kind of took his medicine. So.
Yeah, and Jeremy Hunt did a very nice speech and sort of said, you know, look, my kids, don't be too disappointing. This is democracy. As did Rishi Sunak's speech on his way out of Downing Street. It was unusually gracious for him.
Yes, where's that guy been for the last 18 months? Actually, I think I'd like to change my moment of the night to the Jeremy Hunt concession speech. Not concession, he'd won his seat, but he acknowledged he was on his way out as Chancellor, and he was talking to his children, saying, this is the magic of democracy. We're doing it all, you know, quickly, efficiently, carefully.
No guns, people in Viking horns, people taking a crap on the speaker's desk.
Doesn't take 2 months to do, like some other major Western democracies we can imagine.
I agree, and in a lot of the coverage, there were people saying, well, you have to hand it to Rishi Sunak. He did stabilise things after Liz Truss. And I thought, actually, Jeremy Hunt did. If you remember, he came in as unwanted Chancellor, took all the immediate measures necessary for the country not to totally implode. So he didn't get a lot of credit, and the fact that he vaguely held on, I thought, was quite interesting.
He did plough a lot of his own money, I think, into that seat. He really, really seemed very keen not to be one of the people who lost their seat in Minnesley, where I think, as Michael Gove saw the writing on the wall and was like, Mum,
I'm gone.
Goodbye. Mm. Farewell to Andrew Bridgen, podcast favourite Andrew Bridgen, who came sixth in his seat.
Despite issuing his own election song, which, if listeners, you have not heard, as soon as this podcast is finished, please go to YouTube and listen to The Mighty Andrew Bridgen, his official campaign song.
Well, can we not have a bit of it?
Andrew Bridgen, The Mighty. Done with all the lies, it's time to stand. On July the 4th, we take our land. No more illegal immigrants, we're free. The second verse is about chemtrails. It honestly just gets better. There's 6 minutes of it.
That's actually the kind of thing people are going to be using AI for in the future. Farewell to a lot of SNP MPs. They fell to nine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nine in the end, wasn't it? Seats in the end. I mean, that was an extraordinary. For all the people who said Labour didn't do that well, actually, Scotland is the counterpoint to that, right? Where they were the way to get rid of the SNP sort of domination. People did actually vote Labour in those seats.
Yeah. That was an amazing bit of the coverage, is watching Nicola Sturgeon, who'd been hired to sit there all night.
Yes.
And you just thought, this is very, very masochistic. She's sitting there not having a great deal to say about the rest of the country, watching her own laptop and her life and career going up in tatters.
And John Swinney said, basically sort of conceded, maybe he should have not protected his MSP, who spent $11,000 on the roaming charges to watch the football.
Well, these things are always easier in hindsight, you know.
Can I just point out with the SNP, they've now got about the right number of people to fill a quite substantial camper van.
Hey.
Very strong.
Another one you might have missed, Ian Paisley Jr.
Oh,
lost his seat to some people who were even more right-wing than him in the TV. But A. Paisley has held that seat. It was held by his father from 1970 and him from 2010. So the uninterrupted Paisley rule has been broken.
That is extraordinary. Yeah. Actually, there's just too much news.
I did not realise until Helen told me this morning that Theresa Villiers gone. Therese Coffey being swept off into the sea as like a noxious substance. I did spot that one. But Therese Villiers,
Chief NIMBY, Therese Villiers, has not only been sort of struck out, but also immolated. Her legacy has been immolated by Rachel Reeves on day three.
Can I just point out one that people might have missed as well? Everyone is all about Jacob Rees-Mogg, but in the neighbouring constituency of North Somerset, Liam Fox, off to spend more time with Adam Warity.
Just reading the Stephen Crabbe.
Oh, I forgot him.
No one's thought about him for a little while, perhaps, but he's gone. South Dorset, Richard Drax.
Oh, nice.
I mean, Richard, full name, Richard Grosvenor Plunkett Earnley Earl Drax.
God, that must have taken a while to read out on the platform, hasn't it?
Mark Harper, Transport Secretary, gone. Britain's, until the election, tallest MP, Daniel Krasinski.
Oh, is that?
Yes, gone. He was once done for threatening and intimidating a couple of members of staff and claimed it was partly thanks to his height.
Felt scared rather than they were.
Grant Shapps.
Gone.
Johnny Mercer. Gone. A frequent eye target and a source of great dispute over his exact payment for representing those veterans who he represented in many ways.
Miriam Cates.
Miriam Cates, who has also already offered her prescription for how the Tory party can get better. I mean, it's that sort of Liz Truss-ish Liz cheek, isn't it? It's a, do you not think a period of reflection might be appropriate on your part?
Is it Christian Social Conservatism?
It's more babies, yeah. It's more babies. There's always more babies than Miriam Cates.
So it is quite striking. We should probably make clear that, you know, it's very sad when anyone ever loses their seat.
No, it isn't.
Okay. It's sad for the staff. I mean, that's the thing. I think there are a lot of people who are pretty blameless, have worked really hard, slogged. A lot of campaign volunteers who've slogged around places. And I would like to pay tribute to all of them and the magic of democracy.
Mm. I was very, very taken by seeing all the candidates on the platform. There was a moment when there was a monster-raving loony man who was up there, and I thought, are you going to say that a lot of your candidates turned out to be monsters and raving and loony, and you'd vetted them all, and it wasn't your fault, and obviously you're not raving or loony or a monster, but just seeing them all, it was just such a pleasure.
There is something about the fact that there was someone dressed as Elmo standing next to Keir Starmer as he got his declaration, and I know it's the most sort of basic opinion, but I like the fundamental lack of respect that indicates. Mm-hmm. Not in a mean way, but just in a kind of like, don't get above yourself. We know you're Prime Minister now, but calm down. Absolutely.
Just to mention other novelty candidates, we should note that Rod Liddell lost his deposit, standing for the SDP.
So I think we should have a moment's sadness for that.
Silence.
It's fine. He's still got like 15 columns. I'm sure he'll get a scrape by.
We should talk about some of the other smaller parties, and in the case of the Lib Dems, not so small anymore parties who had good nights. So Reform UK, mm-hmm. can't get away from them. I think the interesting thing about them, and we've spoken a bit about this, is that they've made a very, very, very little bit of progress in the last 10 years since they were effectively UKIP. Mm-hmm. I know Farage says it's a new party, but it's not really.
No.
It's a nice Farage party.
It is the Brexit party, isn't it? It's just got a new badge on it. It's the same setup.
It was set up as the Brexit party.
It is in no way a new party.
In 2014, there were 24 UKIP MEPs elected to the European Parliament. It came top of those European parliamentary elections. Would you like to guess how many of them were still UKIP MEPs by the end of that parliamentary term?
By the end of that term, 24. I'll say down to 12. I'll say they halved.
So much higher than the actual number.
Two.
Nearly there.
Three.
Nearly there.
Four.
Four.
Wow.
So this is your, Adam, this is your Galloway point as well, that UKIP or the successor parties have traditionally been okay at winning seats in particular elections, holding on to those MPs. If you remember, one of them punched someone, one of them got done for expenses irregularities. You know, and I think I would be interested to see whether or not all five of them make it the distance this time. I would say the odds are against.
Yes, we've got Farage, Tice, Lee Anderson, and then two others.
One of whom is 38, which is
good lord,
which is wrong in my
welcome
view.
Welcome to the world of people being younger than you expect.
That's like police officers and doctors being younger than reform MPs.
I'm just feeling great relief that the Prime Minister is finally older than me again after the last two. Thank you very much.
Well, I keep being told, and spent the whole evening being told, that Reform is absolutely huge on TikTok. It's particularly large with 16 to 18 year olds. So if Sir Keir is looking for an early pledge to drop, I think the lowering the voting age would be a good one. I'm just offering that now.
Or reintroduce national service, teach them all, you know, some hard lessons about what's really needed to run a democracy. I think we'll be seeing that soon.
Okay, either or.
But I think the problem is that Farage basically is this is the bit he likes, running for election and getting to make speeches and having everyone look at him. And the actual working with other people is the bit that he really has a serious problem with. I mean, good luck having Lee Anderson and Nigel Farage as two egos in the same room, along with Richard Tice, who at some point has got to get cross with having to just do all the dirty work that Nigel can't be bothered with and stand in for him for the bits he doesn't like doing. Well, Nigel gets in front of the cameras instead. But I mean, there's a history of this. This is what Farage does. He gets elected to things and then he falls out horribly with people. I mean, he did this with Alan Sked, the founder of UKIP. He did it with Nikki Sinclair, a fellow UKIP MEP. Marta Andreasen, do you remember the old EU auditor who inexplicably, having exposed all sorts of corruption with the EU, then decided to tie her flag to UKIP, then fell out horribly with Nigel Farage. Neil Hamilton and Gerard Batten and all of those people who are left in that rump of UKIP, who I think were still fighting a couple of seats this time.
Yes.
Annabel Fuller, his former mistress and spokeswoman and speechwriter, who now has not even no good words to say about him, really, really terrible things to say about him. And in the end, you know, he fell out with UKIP so badly he had to set up his own party, which isn't even a party, as we keep saying. It's a limited company, which is a very, very odd setup. And as you were saying, you know, pretend it's this sort of scrappy startup. And already, I see, they're talking about what they're going to do at the next election and the Labour seats they're going to be targeting the next election. It's not just about elections. You know, you're actually going to have to represent some people in Clacton. Richard Tice is going to have to deal with farmers in Bolton and Skegness who are saying to him, we haven't got anyone to pick our crops anymore. What are you actually going to do about that? It's a bit like, you know, those couples who spend tens of thousands of pounds on their weddings and then realise on sort of the first day of the honeymoon that they don't actually like each other very much and don't want to be married to each other.
Well, I mean, it's a very good analogy because, I mean, in the days before the election, Reform candidates, a number of them were suddenly saying, oh, God, I haven't joined that party, have I? Oh, I didn't realise they were like that.
But you're right exactly about the fact that they now have a little taste of power, which has classically been an issue for smaller parties. And one of the reasons I think the Greens have managed to build themselves into actually a similar situation to the Lib Dems, right, where they often become the kind of local NIMBY party, is that in some of the councils that they've held, they've built up their presence there and done really quite well. So there have been, I think the Brighton experience has been slightly less happy for them, but they have become a functional party at a local level and able to put grassroots campaigners down and really embed themselves in a couple of places. And it'd be very interesting to see whether or not Reform can do anything like that. I would suspect that Nigel Farage will now go back off to the US to go and stand next to Donald Trump for a bit, which I'm not sure the people of Clacton was what they entirely wanted for an MP. But
well, all he said of his intentions in Parliament is that he intends to be a bloody nuisance. But he's got four other people who are down to be a bloody nuisance, so good luck whipping that operation.
But on a voting for celebrity basis, maybe his constituents, if they see him in America next to Trump, will think even better of him.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if your MP is a member of the cabinet, for example, there is normally a little boost, I think, that comes associated with that, and you sort of give them an allowance for not doing maybe as many constituency surgeries as you might hope they do. But there's a little bit attached to it.
Fine.
After all the chat about Rishi Sunak not being worried about holding Richmond North Allerton, he actually held it completely handsomely. Yes. It's on one of the safest Tory seats that there still are. Yeah. So it turns out people do just quite like having the Prime Minister as their candidate.
And within a month, this will be interesting, we'll see what benefits Nigel Farage has received over the last year and all his current financial interests as well, because it's retroactive by 12 months, the register. So not earnings, not everything he's earned, but all the benefits received. So that will be great fun.
I mean, you must be bookmarking some space in the magazine for that. I'm just a wild stab in the dark that there might be some interesting
stuff
in there.
There will be some room, but there was a very good piece last time just about how extraordinary the funding is for Reform, and it's a set of people in Mayfair.
Right.
It really is about as un-Clacton as you could get, and we'll see if the base gets any wider, but at the moment, it isn't.
We should talk about the Lib Dems as well. Speaking of parties which got roughly the same number of votes as Reform.
I don't think they're going to be so keen on proportional representation anymore, are they? I think the fire might have gone out on that one, certainly.
He said today we're going to go for it, even if it means Reform win more.
But they're the only party which has got a rough proportion of seats in the House of Commons to share of national vote.
This was the extraordinary thing about this election, I think, was that people have learned how to work the first-past-the-post system. I mean, it was very much all about tactical voting, I think, and getting the anti-Tory candidate into a lot of constituencies right across Britain, wasn't it?
Well, Jacob Rees-Mogg is evidence of that, and the Libs didn't campaign hard for that seat. And as you say, you would have expected that it was a South West seat, that it would go Lib Dem from Tory, and it didn't. And that's because there was a kind of assumption, agreement, but people worked out who was closest, and then it overtook it.
Did it go Labour then?
Yeah,
Rees-Mogg's seat. Yeah, I assumed it would have gone Lib Dem, but solely because of geography. But there has been a lot of that. I think very few of the Lib Dem. There was one target seat for both Labour and the Lib Dems, which was Nick Clegg's old seat, Sheffield Hallam.
Yeah,
and that's the only one where they had a proper scrap over it, really.
Yeah, and Labour were reasonably challenging in Witney, in which George Osborne's old advisor Rupert Harrison didn't win. It went, it didn't go to him. So yeah, but I mean there were quite a few three-way marginals, and there are now more seats that have been subject to huge swings back and forward in the last 10 years. There's very few now what you would call ultra safe seats.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting. That the last few years, people have spent time telling us that it's all about identity politics now. And people seem to have abandoned those old sort of identities of I'm a Labour person or I'm a Lib Dem person and I will be them till I die. In the same way that they have with newspapers, haven't they? You know, people, no one defines themselves by the newspaper they read anymore. That those sort of loyalties seem to have died away completely.
That was always the red wall kind of question, was if you had been somebody who'd voted Labour all your life and you decided to flirt with Reform or Boris Johnson's sort of Brexit Tory party, did you then snap back to being Labour? Or at that point, are you actually a swing voter? And I'd be interested to see what the analysis of that is, but I suggest probably that may be where it where it is. I think you're right. I think some of those things, those tribal loyalties have been broken, and I don't think you ever really go back to them in the same way.
I think the other thing that people forget, as older people who tend to be doing the analysis on this kind of thing, like us, is that every generation that comes through sees things completely differently. I mean, the thing that amazed me on my first vote was in 1997, when there was absolutely a much more enthusiastic view than there has been in this one of we've got to get this awful, knackered government out and get Labour in. And I was really surprised to find when my nieces and nephews came up to their first vote, which was in 2010, they felt exactly the same way in the opposite direction, that they were just, my God, we've had Labour in for 13 years. They're so knackered and sleazy, and we've got to get them out. And that, you know, each generation does come through differently, which suggests to me, as you were saying, Ian, that, you know, the 16 and 17-year-olds, if they get votes, may see things very differently to how we expect them to.
One of the things I did notice with in a number of the Vox Pops on the night was people saying, I'm very disillusioned with the Tories, but I cannot vote Labour, so I'm voting Lib Dem. And you wanted to say, have you noticed how left-wing the Lib Dems are now? The idea of Labour in your head isn't exactly what you would be hoping with the Lib Dems. So, yes, I think there's a lot of clever tactical voting, and I think there's a lot of slightly catching up tactical voting going on as well.
It wasn't as weird as 2015, when a lot of people said, we want to punish the Lib Dems for going into coalition with the Tories, so we're going to vote Tory instead. That was the weirdest election we've ever.
So, that is enough stamping on the cinders of the last government. Let's start gloriously, brick by brick, tearing down the next one.
What was that phrase from Keir Starmer, with the pale sunlight of hope? I thought that sort of summed it up, really. It wasn't kind of like, yeah, things going to get better. It was like, oh, yeah, right.
Things good. Yeah. You know, yeah. So we've got a lot of so hello thens. I mean, a couple of hundred of them, to be honest. I think it's the House of Commons with the most new members, certainly in living or recent memory. I mean, about half the MPs in the House of Commons have not been in the House of Commons before. Very rare.
The Private Eye series, new boys and new girls, will start next issue and will run as long as they're still there.
We've got about 200 issues. What's that? That's 10 years.
Yeah, that's about right.
Decade of national renewal. There we go.
A lot of them are lobbyists in the Labour. It's really interesting to look at the breakdown, because obviously it costs a lot of money to run as an MP, and you know, have to be quite a masochist to do it. So that, I think that new Labour intake will be really interesting to scrutinise, you know, and also about massive Lib Dem new intake too. I mean, very few survivors from the coalition still left.
Yes, how was their vetting? I have no idea. We heard a lot about Labour vetting all its candidates, you know, scrupulously to make sure that they were centrist dads and mums, I suppose. But the new Lib Dems, unknown quantity.
I know some of them might be in favour of building houses. They might have slipped through the net, you can say.
So is there anyone new who you're especially interested in the new intake?
Well, my new person that I thought was a really interesting one is not a new MP. He's a new Lord. And that's James Timpson, who was one of the first people he announced in the Cabinet as a prisons and probation minister, which I just think is a really, really interesting job. I mean, this is getting experts in, basically. He announced him along with Patrick Vallance coming in as Minister for Science, and the new Attorney General, whose name for a moment escapes me.
Casey. Yeah.
Who was also an extremely experienced lawyer, rather than being, God, who else have we had in that post? Suella Braverman, who I think had done some photocopying in a lawyer's office once on work experience, and Liz Truss, who I don't think it done anything, really.
No, it was pretty tough on Emily Thornberry, who's been a pretty dogged shadow for the entirety of the miserable opposition years. But I think the idea was that he wanted someone who's a very recently practising internet. Given that Keir Starmer sort of prides himself as being a lawyer, I don't know if he's ever mentioned that he ran the DPP. Yeah. I think he wanted somebody who was really up to date with their practice. So that's why Richard Hermer got picked. Another great Lord will be Rishi Sunak's former Chief of Staff, Liam Booth-Smith, who's been rewarded for his exquisite judgment in deciding to have an early election by going to the Lords. So that's nice.
Are you allowed to have a sort of leather jacket ermine combination? Sorry, that's a very niche joke about what he likes wearing.
Leather ermine jacket, yes.
But, I mean, Sunak, having said, I am not Boris all along, ends up with a totally gratuitous peerage, which is just as embarrassing and pathetic.
He can sit next to Ross Kempsel and Charlotte Owen, can't he? It's just...
But those political appointments, I thought they were the sort of they're normally after the end of term, as it were. You don't do the political ones in your dissolution on us.
Wait. But, I mean, again, like all sort of traditions and protocols, they go out the window as soon as anyone cares. And presumably, Rishi Sunak thought, if I don't give it to him now, someone will sit on this and say, this is embarrassing.
Do you reckon? I mean, it feels to me like another example of what kept being trotted out before the election, which was that Rishi Sunak isn't very good at politics.
Mm.
Which again feels...
Doesn't matter anymore, does it?
No.
I mean, personally, if you were good at politics, you would have waited until the polls had closed to say, yeah, I'm giving a peerage to Chris Grayling, wouldn't you?
Oh.
There was still half an hour where people could get down to the ballot box and register their dissent at that one.
I did a sort of 2 a.m. tweet that's like, can we park this and come back to it? I mean, the man who destroyed the probation service by carving it in half, I mean, as extensively covered in Private Eye, deciding to give all the high-risk cases, keep them in the public one, and then carve off what he thought would be the easy, lucrative ones to the private sector. The private sector then says, oh, actually, we can't do this. It turns out it's probation servicing quite hard, actually. They then have to sew it all back together. I mean, in a decade of terrible ministers, Chris Grayling is the worst.
And you're not even bringing up the ferries, and you're not even bringing up him banning reading and books in cells. All of his departments, I mean, a lot of them, Michael Gove had to go in and sort out. And, you know, I didn't think I'd hear myself saying that.
Hooray.
No, it's extraordinary. And I mean, much as I love the idea we all move on, let's not quite forget.
I'm never moving on. Hilary Cass of the Cass Report into Youth Gender Services got one in a peerage in the Dissolution Honours. And that's nice. I think that's the same thing as Timpson, right? Which is putting in people who are in civil society, who have expertise relevant to legislation that you might be considering.
And we should say the reason, just for any listeners who don't know, is that James Timpson runs Timpson, who, you know, shoes mended, keys cut, who employ a lot of recent ex-prisoners, and provide a lot of pathways back into the workplace after people have done time.
Yes, and he's also involved, I think, with the Prison Reform Trust and various other kind of big initiatives, as well as those that he's doing through Timpson, who are one of those real sort of amazing, slightly Victorian-era employers, a bit like William Lever or Titus Salt or someone. Who...
And you are literally, Andy, looking at a sole on my shoe put on. At Timpson's. And very, very well, too.
And I think that's really interesting because people initially wanted to portray that as a Labour going soft on crime, which is combined with the fact that Shabana Mahmood, the new Justice Secretary, is going to have to early release a lot of people.
Right.
That was just something that was going to happen because the prisons are overflowing and there hasn't been any work done in the 6 weeks that we were in Purdah because of the election campaign. But the thing I thought was really smart about Timpson is... He has quite a few rules. He doesn't take men under 25 because he thinks that those people aren't ready to kind of turn their life around. Mm. They don't take sex offenders because they're often very manipulative. Mm. So he has got a hard-headed realism.
He's not starry-eyed, is he? He's not Mrs. Jellyby, no. He's absolutely.
So this is something that interests me, the sort of appointing experts, because it's very... unfamiliar territory.
Well, it's Gordon Brown's government of all the talents, if you remember, which didn't necessarily always work out that well.
But that was a very late New Labour idea, if you like. And I just found myself wondering, is this interesting because this is a big change of government as opposed to simply one Conservative Prime Minister to the next? Is this unusual? Will it keep happening? Because what you found in the later years of the Conservative government is there's lots of shuffling the deck chairs. You know, you are slowly running out of people who you might be able to give ministerial jobs. There are about 100 ministerial jobs, aren't there? Is that roughly the size of the... with senior and junior ministers all in?
More even 100. Than that. And then you can have almost any number that you want unpaid. There's only a cap on the number of paid ministers in the payroll vote.
Yeah.
But you're right.
If you've got 300 and... is it 26? If you've got a small majority, one-third of your MPs are going to be ministers, unless you appoint from outside. So after a certain number of years, you're inevitably going to be moving people around, which is why you see Grant Shapps or Michael Gove or whoever go round and round lots of different departments. Whereas here, it felt like these people have been mastering their brief, or certainly in a shadow position for some years, and then they get posted. Is that something that we can expect to be a lasting change, or is it just the consequence of having a big changeover?
I would say, historically, there is always a moment where governments of whatever stripe say, it's time we had someone who's actually done something. So you get in people from business. Mrs. Thatcher loved Lord Young, if you remember. You bring me problems, he brings me solutions. I mean, there was all that sort of reverence for business and expertise. And I think it does go in waves. There was a Blairite period where it was, we must have people who've done things. The next Tory lot, do you remember, they got in the man who ran Asda. They got Archie Norman was suddenly, this is the sort of person we want in. But then we hit Gove, which was, we don't want experts anymore. And do write in and correct me and say that's unfair and not the full quote. But you know what I mean.
It was also the fact that you have to reward more and more people in order to buy them off. And that's one of the things that's interesting about this transition, is that Starmer has appointed lots of people who shadowed those briefs in opposition. There's been very few changes. He obviously had to swap out Thangam Debonair and Jonathan Ashworth, who both didn't win their seats. Mm. Annalise Dodds has been downgraded to only Minister of State. But, you know, essentially it was a kind of trying to smoothly port over. However, that does leave approximately 19 billion Labour MPs without a job. And with, you know, with, and there'll be some select committee chairships coming up. There's not a lot of baubles that he can buy them off with. Yeah. And people, so people kind of go, oh, it's terrible, the supermajority, it'll be so undemocratic. And I just feel that someone who's covered the Labour Party for a long time, it's very possible for them to argue amongst themselves. I really wouldn't worry about that.
This is another thing I found interesting about the appointment of Patrick Vallance, because he's been brought in as a science minister. Mm. He actually appeared on a podcast in November, the Carbon Trust podcast, and he was talking about how you apply the lessons of COVID and the vaccine program to net zero. And it just gives you a bit of an indication of the things that matter most to them. Firstly, it's an indication of how long these things have been in the works and being planned, as in it wasn't like the election happened and then Starmer phoned up Patrick Vallance and said, we've just thought of this. So his messages were things like, you need to have clear, objective, measurable, you know, time-bound aims of what you're trying to do, whether that's vaccines or net zero, whatever it is. And that seems to be a big thing for the Starmer project, is measurable, you know, deliverable but measurable. They haven't given an awful lot of concrete commitments about when things are going to get better, but supposedly that's part of it. And the other thing he said was bring experts into government quickly.
Hurrah.
Weeks, not months or years. So, you know, his advice has come in handy there.
It's the point you can do it as well, isn't it? When you have got that big majority and they're fresh in, that actually, if you're ever going to be able to have a proper, sensible, mature conversation about prisons, which don't work and have never worked, and it's insane that we are spending so much money on putting people in prison and bring and so they can become worse criminals and then bring them out again, now is the only possible time to do it. And maybe you can defy all of that kind of coverage, which is going to say, oh, soft on crime, soft on prisons, and do something
like that. The word lags is going to start to appear. It only appears in tabloid stories about prisons. Do you want a quick Labour Nepo watch?
Yeah.
Sue Gray's son is now an MP.
Okay.
Yeah. Morgan McSweeney, who is the kind of architect of Starmerism, his wife is now an MP for a Scottish constituency. But sadly for me, as I think, as I was hoping this to happen, no Joe Dancy, who is Mr. West Streeting. I'd hope that we'd have the first pair of married men in the Commons, and that's we haven't yet had that. Of course, you know, we had Yvette Cooper and Ed Balls, if you remember, as the first married couple in the Cabinet. But
I am looking forward to Yvette Cooper being giving a real grilling on Good Morning.
Yeah, so
I mean, these boats, they haven't stopped. We're a week in, Yvette. Come on. So what's the plan? What's the plan, Yvette? What is the plan?
Hey, speaking of faces from the past, just in case I myself am looking too starry-eyed about James Timpson and Patrick Vallance and all these kind of experts coming in, within 12 hours, my heart sunk when I saw a couple of old faces back in the Cabinet. We've got Jackie Smith, former Home Secretary and wife of porn user on expenses. And another man who's featured in the eye an awful lot over the years, Alan Milburn, who was one of those many Blairite people like John Reid, who just used to get shuffled around different departments, didn't he? And seemed to be the answer to everything. Let's just give it to Alan Milburn.
So go on, tell us what you've got against Alan Milburn.
He was Health Secretary from 1999 until 2003, quite instrumental during his time in health, pushing PFI into hospitals and, you know, opening up a lot of private contracts, a lot of outsourcing, this kind of thing. And his most recent appearances in the eye have been because he's made a number of, you know, he's written articles, he's appeared on Newsnight, and every time he's, you know, he's Alan Milburn, former Health Secretary, rather than Alan Milburn, who is also the chair of the advisory board at the private equity group Bridgepoint, director of medical technic firm Human Therapeutics, doesn't sound sinister at all, director of a Spanish health giant, senior advisor to PwC's UK government and health industries practice, lots and lots and lots of jobs, all, you know, private health and kind of pushing private health and saying, look, don't be afraid of it, it's wonderful, really.
And the pieces always say, could someone point out that he has a vested interest here? And when the broadcasters have him on, could he mention he's a pretty major lobbyist, either for his own interests or for other people's? And he's not just the health secretary who, from a Labour government, who you'd imagine would have a particular view, but they never do. So we have to keep repeating the piece. Anyway, now he's back in government.
That's very interesting to me, because I think it has been, I mean, I remember reading Barbara Castle biographies about pay beds in the, you know, 1970s. They're like, the amount of private intrusion you have into the health service is always going to be something that is a thorn in the side of the Labour government. Wes Streeting has said that he's open to it. You know, he'd said if he hadn't been able to get his scan for his kidney cancer through the NHS, if he had to wait a month, he said at that point he would have gone private. So he's definitely in a different place to other people.
Yeah.
I think also, honestly, in Islington North, where Jeremy Corbyn held on to his seat as an independent, the fact that he was running against a guy who ran a private chain of IVF clinics was actually something that he really made a big deal about in the campaign literature, about I'm in favour of the NHS, this is guy's a private healthcare provider. So it's a point where actually Labour's base and, you know, or I would say not exactly his base, its campaigning base may be very out of tune with what they end up now doing in government. And that could be a real sore spot as we go on.
That's interesting. But
can I just make the point that I will try and make whenever we get in front of one of these select committees? I mean, I don't mind people being private health providers and running businesses. Do they also have to be in the government? Could we not have people in the government who don't own large companies that are going to benefit? And then they could make the decision. And if their decision, Wes Streeting's decision, is that we need more private healthcare owners, then we could appoint one that, say, isn't in the government. I mean, why can't we split these things?
Sounds very inefficient, Ian. Why would just one person?
I'd just like to bring up one of my other bugbears as well, which is that the requirements of the Register of Lords' interests are a lot less stringent than the ones of the House of Commons. Huh. You don't have to declare figures as strictly as you do if you're an MP, which is something that I've been saying for years really, really needs to be tightened up, because there's no reason for it. But if you're going to start appointing junior ministers or even senior ministers from the House of Lords, then, you know, with business interests, then you really have to have a look at that.
Is that why we didn't learn maybe as much as we could have done about David Cameron's interests? Because I think there was lots of interest in his interest in China, for example, and there was the whole Greensill palaver.
Yeah, and John Prescott, we never found out exactly how much he was being paid for his Sunday Mirror column at the time when he was inveigling against the News International newspapers, their rivals, right, for their involvement in phone hacking and ignoring his own newspaper groups. Yeah, there are all sorts of things.
We never found out what Nadine Dorries was getting for her various talk TV and mail gigs, but that's because she didn't declare, and then left. So...
Yeah, well, I hope Channel 4 are happy with whatever they paid her for election night.
We should wrap up shortly. Are there any more things looking forward, any more fights that you're looking forward to, or any more discussions that you're looking forward to seeing how they play out over the next couple of years?
First big Labour scandal, and I'm not going to predict what it is, but we'll have one before Christmas. I remember, so I started here on Work Experience late 97, when it was a very odd time for the Eye, because readers were kind of, it's all over now. We don't want, there's no more sleaze or anything. This is a lovely, shiny new government.
Give them a chance.
And I remember, do you remember the first big one, Ian, was the tobacco donations,
yes,
Bernie Eccleston.
Mr. Eccleston.
And there was suddenly this moment, as when Tony Blair had to...
For younger listeners, please.
They were cracking down on tobacco advertising, but they decided to have a loophole that would allow them still to sponsor Formula One.
Proprietor Bernie Eccleston,
who it turned out had given, I think, £1 million pounds to Labour, completely coincidentally, of course. And moment when Tony Blair was ordered by Alistair Campbell, who was the one giving the orders at that point, to go on the BBC and take a kicking. And he said famously, I think people know I'm a pretty straight kind of guy. And it was the moment when people realised, maybe actually he wasn't.
No, you've just literally done that. I'm a black is white, 2 + 2 = 5 kind of guy.
Which, to be fair, he was really, really good at. But,
well, that's why he went on and took the kicking, because Gordon Brown, who was absolutely incensed and devastated and thought, I can't believe we've got to do this. this is what I didn't want to go into politics for. He didn't.
Can I nominate housing? Which, as you know, is a pet issue of mine. And there's a really interesting thing where Rachel Reeves' first speech as Chancellor was basically like, build, baby, build. Mm-hmm. So there's no more ban on onshore wind farms, for example. She's Angela Rayner, who will now be in charge of housing policy, essentially, is going to call in a couple of the developments that were blocked. They're going to try and, for example, unbung near where my parents live, Worcestershire Parkway Station. There's bizarrely a park and ride station in the middle of nowhere waiting for the housing development that you always assumed would come around it. And as nonetheless not appeared. So they are really determined to block what is now being called the kind of anti-growth coalition. Theresa Villiers, who is like the arch NIMBY, lost her seat. And that's the interesting thing now. And I think it's a particularly interesting fight because it shows the split between the kind of much older Tory voting base, who are largely very worried about protecting their asset prices and amenities, and the Tory think tanks, who are all like, but we need some economic growth. This is one of the only ways to do it. So all the energy in the kind of Tory intellectual right, which is mostly people under 50, are all desperate to build some houses, whereas the Tory voters are very anti and quite worried about it.
Well, there was a Griselda cartoon in this very issue, which is someone with a red rosette saying, build more houses now, and someone with a blue rosette saying, build more houses somewhere else.
my other interesting thing I'm just fascinated by, it's a very small issue, but it's the refurbishment of Parliament. Is anyone going to actually take it on? Is it because it's been kicked down the road many, many years in a row and
riddled with mice, and I think at some point might burn down. I mean, that is the traditional way that Parliament gets rebuilt, is that every so often it just burns down and we have another one.
Do we just put them all in a shed with computer links and it'll be fine, and we turn the House of Parliament into a big museum or a theme park or a karaoke night?
Ed Davey would love it if it was a theme park.
he could be MC.
Ed Davey's House of Fun.
He's the only MP who's going to have a space hopper instead of a green bench to sit on.
Well, that's your option. And I think people will fight that, not on cost, which is absolutely unbelievable, but on a sort of how moth-eaten are we, and is moth-eaten okay? What traditional value is there in that? I mean, if like me, you're quite keen on Pugin and the building as a whole, it'll be difficult.
Isn't it one of the issues is that there aren't enough seats now for all of the Labour MPs on one side of the house? So, I mean, if ever there was a time.
The whole thing will tilt over. I mean, it'll be unbalanced and it will just start listing. Right. That's it from us. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, there is a magazine, a related magazine called Private Eye. Go and buy it. Or go to private-eye.co.uk and get yourself a subscription, which is reasonably priced, and you'll be making a long-term decision for a brighter future. Thanks to Ian, Helen and Adam. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio, who, as always, produced this episode. Goodbye.